Chapter 3. Sleep Walkers. The World of Early Trance. The Awakening of the Species. Dreams, Evolution, and Value Fulfillment. Volume 1, a Seth book. Continuing Session 888. Chapter 3. 3. Sleepwalkers. The World in Early Trance. The Awakening of the Species. Those are the headings. Give us a moment. You have taught yourself to respond to certain neural patterns and to ignore alternate ones that now simply operate as background activity. That background activity, however, supports a million forces, the neutral stimuli that you accept as biologically real. Those other background stimuli are now quite difficult for you to identify, but they are always there in the hinterland of your waking consciousness, like dream chatter way beneath your usual associations. Neurologically, you tune into only a portion of your body's reality and are ignorant of the great, tiny, but tumultuous communications that are ever flying back and forth in the microscopic but vital cellular world. Electrons, in your terms, are precognitive, and so is your cellular consciousness. Your body's relative permanence in time is dependent upon the electron's magnificent behavior as it deals with probabilities. The cell's stability and its reliability in the bodily environment is dependent upon its innate properties of instant communication and instant decision. For each cell is in communication with all others and is united with all others through fields of consciousness, in which each entity of whatever degree plays a part. At one level, your cells obey the rules of time, but on other levels they defy it. All of these communications are a part of the human parcel of reality, and they all exist beneath what you think of as normal consciousness. Events are not built up initially from physical particles. They are the result of psychological activity. Give us a moment. In the beginning, you were only aware of that psychological activity. It had not, as yet, thickened itself into form. The form was there, but it was not manifest. I do not particularly like the analogy, but it is useful. Instead of small particles, you had small units of consciousness, gradually building themselves into larger ones. But a smaller unit of consciousness, you see, is not less than a larger unit, for each unit of consciousness contains within itself the innate heritage of all that is. You think of the conscious mind as you know it, as the only kind of consciousness with a deliberate intent, awareness of itself as itself, and with a capacity for logic and appreciation of symbolism. That only seems true because of your particular range of activity, and because you can only pinpoint events within a particular psychological spectrum. End of dictation. For our friend. Rob notes, now Seth gave a few paragraphs for Jane, then said good night at 10:10. Even with the many pauses she'd used this evening, most of which I didn't indicate, Jane's delivery had often been quite intent and meaningful. In their own way, the pauses served as additional punctuation and emphasis for some of Seth's information. Session 889, continuing Chapter 3, Sleepwalkers. The World of Early Trance, The Awakening of the Species. From Dreams, Evolution, and Value Fulfillment, Volume 1. December 17, 1979. Rob notes, on December 13, Jane came up with her best title yet for the book of poetry she's putting together, If We Live Again, Love's Lives and Probable Selves. She's writing some excellent new poems for the book, besides working on God of Jane. My wife is also doing some poetry as a Christmas present for me, though she's very secretive about this activity. I'm not supposed to know what she's up to. Last night was our coldest of the winter, I believe about 9 degrees, and this evening wasn't much warmer as we set for the session. However, the season has been exceptionally warm in our area. The ground has been bare of snow most of the time so far. Seth, dictation. Now, I call the building blocks of matter CUs, units of consciousness. They form physical matter as it exists in your understanding and experience. Units of consciousness also form other kinds of matter that you do not perceive. CUs can also operate as particles or as waves. Whichever way they operate, they are aware of their own existences. When CUs operate as particles, in your terms, they build up a continuity in time. They take on the characteristics of particularity. They identify themselves as the establishment of specific boundaries. They take certain forms, then, when they operate as particles, and experience their reality from the center of those forms. They concentrate upon, or focus upon, their unique specifications. They become, in your terms, individual. When CUs operate as waves, however, they do not set up any boundaries about their own self-awareness. And when operating as waves, CUs can indeed be in more than one place at one time. I understand that this is somewhat difficult material to comprehend. However, in its purest form, a unit of consciousness can be in all places at the same time. It becomes besides the point, then, to say that when it operates as a wave, a unit of consciousness is precognitive or clairvoyant, since it has the capacity to be in all places and all times simultaneously. Those units of consciousness are the building blocks for the physical material of your body, for the trees and rocks, the oceans, the continents, and very manifestation of space itself as you understand it. Rob notes, Seth repeated the last phrase very loudly when I failed to understand him the first time. Seth, these CUs can operate as separate entities, as identities, or they can flow together in a vast, harmonious wave of activity, as a force, period. Actually, units of consciousness operate in both ways all of the time. No identity, once formed, is ever annihilated, for its existence is indelibly a part of the entire wave of consciousness to which it belongs. Each particleized unit, however, rides the continual thrust set up by fields of consciousness in which wave and particle both belong. Each particularized unit of consciousness contains within it, inherently, the knowledge of all other such particles, for at other levels, again, the units are operating as waves. Basically, the units move faster than light, slowing down in your terms to form matter. These units can be considered, again, as entities or as forces, and they can operate as either. Metaphysically, they can be thought of as the point at which all that is acts to form your world. The immediate contact of a never-ending creative inspiration coming into mental focus, the metamorphosis of certainly divine origin that brings the physical world into existence from the greater reality of divine fact. Scientifically, again, the units can be thought of as the building blocks of matter. Ethically, the CUs represent the spectacular foundations of the world in value fulfillment, for each unit of consciousness is related to each other, a part of the other, each participating in the entire gestalt of mortal experience. And we will see how this applies to your attitudes toward specieshood and man's relationship with other conscious entities and the planet he shares with them. In the beginning, CUs, then, units of consciousness, existing within a divine psychological gestalt, endowed with the unimaginable creativity of that sublime identity, began themselves to create, to explore, and to fulfill those innate values by which they were characterized. Operating both as waves and particles, directed in part by their own creative restlessness, and directed in part by the unquenchable activity of all that is, they embarked upon the project that brought time and space and your entire universe into being. They were the first entities then. I want to try and imagine a situation in which there exists a psychological force that includes within it capabilities, the ability to act simultaneously on the most microscopic and most macroscopic levels, that can form within itself a million separate, inviolate, unique identities, and that can still operate as a part of those identities and as a larger unit that is their source, in which case it is a wave from which the particles emerge. That description fits our units of consciousness. They build your world from the inside out. As physical creatures, they focused upon what you think of as physical identities, separate, individual differences, endowing each physical consciousness with its own original variations and creative potentials, its own opportunity for completely original experience, and a viewpoint or platform from which to participate in reality, one that at that level could not be experienced in the same way by any other individual. This is the privileged, always new, private and immediate, direct experience of any individual of any species, or of any degree, as it encounters the objective universe. At other levels, while each individuality is maintained, it rides the wave-like formations of consciousness. It is everywhere at once, and the units of consciousness that make up your cells know the positions of all other such units, both in time and in space. In the beginning, then, these units operated both as identities or particles and as waves. The main concentration was not yet physical in your terms. What you now think of as the dream state was the waking one, for it was still the recognized form of purposeful activity, creativity, and power. The dream state continues to be a connective between the two realities, and as a species, you literally learned to walk by first being sleepwalkers. You walked in your sleep. You dreamed your languages. You spoke in your dreams and later wrote down the alphabets. And your knowledge and your intellect have always been fired, sharpened, propelled by the great inner reality from which your minds emerged. Physical matter by itself could never produce consciousness. One mind alone could not come into being from chance alone. One thought could not leap from an infinite number of nerve ends. If matter itself was not initially alive with consciousness, packed with the intent to be. A man who believes life has little meaning quickly leaves life, and a meaningless existence could never produce life. Nor was the universe created for one species alone, by a god who is simply a supervision of the same species. As willful and destructive as man at his worst, instead, you have an inner dimension of activity, a vast field of multidimensional creativity, a creator that becomes a portion of each of its creations, and yet a creator that is greater than the sum of its parts, a creator that can know itself as a mouse in a field, or as the continent upon which the field rests, or as the planet that holds the continent, or as the universe that holds the world, a force that is whole, yet divisible, that is one, and the inconceivably many, a force that is eternal and mortal at once, a force that plunges headlong into its own creativity, forming the seasons and experiencing them as well, glorifying in individualization, and yet always aware of the great unity that is within and behind and through all experiences of individuality. A force from which each moment passes, and futures flow out in every conceivable direction. Rob notes, Jane delivered the whole paragraph with great flowing intensity, and I punctuated it to the best of my ability just as it came through her. I don't think I've ever heard her speak so eloquently for Seth, and with more certainty, this book has turned her on. Seth. In your terms of time, however, we will speak of a beginning. And in that beginning, it was man's, early man's dreams that allowed him to cope with physical reality. The dream world was his original learning ground. In times of drought, he would dream of the location of water. In times of famine, he would dream of the location of food. That is, his dreaming allowed him to clairvoyantly view the body of land. He would not waste time in the trial and error procedures that you now take for granted. In dreams, his consciousness operated as a wave. In those early times, all species shared their dreams in a way that is now quite unconscious for your kind. So that in dreams man inquired of the animals also, long before he learned to follow the animal tracks, for example. Where is their food or water? What is the lay of the land? Man explored the planet because his dreams told him that the land was there. People were not nearly as isolated as it now appears. For in their dreams, early man communicated their various locations, the symbols of their cultures and understanding, the nature of their arts. All of the inventions that you often think now happened quite by chance, the discovery of anything from the first tool to the importance of fire, or the coming of the Iron Age, or whatever, all of that inventiveness was the result of the inspiration and communication of the dream world. Man dreamed his world and then created it, and the units of consciousness first dreamed man and all of the other species that you know. There is a point here that I want to emphasize before we go too far, and it is this. The dream world is not an aimless, non-logical, unintellectual field of activity. It is only that your own perceptive closes out much of its vast reality. For the dreaming intellect can put your computers to shame. I am not, therefore, putting the intellectual capacities in the background. But I am saying that they emerge as you know them because of the dreaming self, uninterrupted use of the full power of the united intellect and intuitions. The intellectual abilities, as you know them, cannot compare to those greater capacities that are a part of your own inner reality. End of dictation. Rob. Okay. Now Seth came through with a paragraph, here deleted, for Jane and me. Then, Seth, do you have questions? Rob, what do you think of my remarks about watching the news on television every day? Seth, it makes little difference whether you watch the news or not, but it makes all the difference in the world what you think of the world events. The perspective from which you watch world events is vital, and it is true that communication now brings to the conscious mind a far greater barrage than before. But it is also a barrage that makes man see his own activities, and even with the growth of new nationalism in the third world, those nations begin from a new perspective, in which the eyes of the world are indeed upon them. Your country faces the results of its own policies, its greed, as well as its good intent, but it is out in the open in a new way. The world will be seen as one, but there may be changes in the overall tax assessments along the way, as those who have not paid much pay more. The results of fanaticism are also out in the open. Never before, in your terms, has the private person been able to see a picture of the mass world in such a way, or been forced to identify with the policies of his or her government. That in itself is a creative achievement, and means that man is not closing his eyes to the iniquities of his world. End of session. A fond good evening. Rob, the same to you, Seth. Thank you very much. 10:18 p.m. Talk about energy. Jane exclaimed as soon as she was out of her excellent trance state. I just had the feeling we were getting some great stuff. I just had the feeling. I don't remember what he said that well, but I just felt that terrific conviction. You know what I mean? I certainly did. I congratulated her upon the session. Session 890, December 19, 1979. Continuing Chapter 3. Dreams, Evolution, and Value Fulfillment, a Seth book. Chapter 3, Sleepwalkers, The World in Early Trance, The Awakening of the Species. Now, good evening. Rob, good evening, Seth. Seth, dictation. This inner universe is a gestalt formed by fields of awareized energy that contains what we will call information for now. But we will have some comments later, for this is not the kind of information you are used to. Each unit of consciousness inherently possesses within itself all of the information available to the whole, and its specific nature, when it operates as a particle, rests upon that great body of inner knowledge. Any one such particle can be where it is, be what it is, and B, when it is, only because the positions, relative positions, and situations of all such particles are known. In the deepest terms, again, your physical world is beginning at each point at which these units of consciousness assert themselves to form physical reality. Otherwise, life would not be handed down through the generations. Each unit of consciousness, or CU, intensifies, magnifies its own intent to be, and you might say, works up from within itself an explosive spark of primal desire that explodes into a process that causes physical materialization. It turns into what I have called an EE unit, in which case it is embarked upon its own kind of physical experience. These EE units also operate as fields, as waves, or as particles, as the units of consciousness do, but in your terms they are closer to physical orientation. Their die is cast, so to speak. They have already begun that special kind of screening process necessary that will bring about physical form. They begin to deal with the kinds of information that will help form your world. There are literally numberless steps taken before EE units combine in their own fashion to form the most microscopic physical particles, and even here the greatest, gentlest, sorting out process takes place as these units disentangle themselves at certain operational levels from their own greater fields of information to specialize in the various elements that will allow for the production of atoms and molecules impeccably suited to your kind of world. Rob. By now, Jane was moving into a more subdued form of that rolling, resonant delivery for Seth that she'd used in the last session. Seth. First again, you have various stages of, say, pseudo-matter, of dream images, that only gradually, in those terms, coalesce and become physically viable. For there are endless varieties of matter between the matter that you recognize and the antimatter of physicists' theories. Form exists at many other levels than those you recognize, in other words. Your dream forms are quite as real as your physical ones. They simply fit into their own environment at another level of activity, and they are quite reminiscent of the kinds of forms that you had in the beginning of your world. While you and all of the other species were what I have called sleepwalkers, your bodies by then were physically capable. In a manner of speaking, you did not know how to use them properly as yet. Now, from a waking state, you do not understand how your dream bodies can seem to fly through the air, defy space and even time, converse with strangers, and so forth. In the same way, however, once you had to learn to deal with gravity, to deal with space and time, to manipulate in a world of objects, to simply breathe, to digest your food, and to perform all of the biological manipulations that now you take for granted. You could not afford to identify too completely with such bodies until you learned how to survive within them. So in the dream state, the true processes of life began as these new bodies and earth-tuned consciousnesses saw themselves mentally exercising all portions of the body. Behind all that was the brilliant comprehension and cooperation of all of the units of consciousness that go to compose the body, each adding its own information and specific knowledge to the overall bodily organizations, and each involved in the most intricate fields of relationships, for the miracle of the body's efficiency is the result of relationships that exist among all of its parts, connecting it to other levels of existence that do not physically appear. Units of consciousness, CUs, transforming themselves into EE units, formed the environment and all of its inhabitants in the same process, in what you might call a circular manner rather than a serial one. And in those terms, of course, there are only various physical manifestations of consciousness, not a planet and its inhabitants, but an entire gestalt of awareized consciousness. In those terms, each portion of physically oriented consciousness sees reality and experience from its own privileged viewpoint, about which it seemed all else revolves. Even though this may involve a larger generalized field than your own or a smaller one. So too, rocks say you can be considered a portion of their environment, while you may consider them merely a portion of your environment. You simply do not tune into the range of rock consciousness. Actually, many other kinds of consciousness, while focused in their own specific ways, are more aware than man is of Earth's unified nature. But man, in following his own ways, also adds to the value fulfillment of all other consciousnesses in ways that are quite outside of usual systems of knowledge. If you remember that beneath all, each unit of consciousness is aware of the position of each other unit, and that these units form all physical matter, then perhaps you can intuitively follow what I mean. For whatever knowledge man attains, whatever experience any one person accumulates, whatever arts or sciences you produce, all such information is instantly perceived at other levels of activity by each of the other units of consciousness that compose physical reality, whether those units form the shape of a rock, a raindrop, an apple, a cat, a frog, or a shoe. Manufactured products are also composed of atoms and molecules that ride upon units of consciousness transformed into EE units and hence into physical elements. What you have really is a manifested and an unmanifested consciousness, but only relatively speaking. You do not perceive the consciousness of objects. It is not manifest to you because your range of activities requires boundaries to frame your pictures of reality. All of your manufactured objects also originated in the realm of dreams, first obviously being conceived of mentally, and in the same way man produced his first tools. He was born with all of those abilities by which he is now characterized, and with other abilities that in your terms still wait for development. Not that he has not used them so far, but that he has not focused upon them in what you consider the main lines of civilized continuity. Hints of those abilities are always present in the dream state, and in the arts, in the religions, and even in the sciences. They appear in politics and business, but are the largely unmanifest intuitive background, which is largely ignored. We will return to these later in the book. Man's dreams have always provided him with a sense of impetus, purpose, meaning, and given him the raw material from which to form his civilizations. The true history of a world is the history of man's dreams, for they have been responsible in one way or another for all historical developments. They are responsible for the birth of agriculture, as well as industry, the rise and fall of nations, the glory that was Rome, and Rome's destruction. Your present technological advances can almost be dated from the invention of the printing press to Edison's inventions, which were flashes of intuition, dream-inspired. But if what I am telling you is true, then it is obvious that when I say that your physical world originated in the world of dreams, I must mean something far different from the usual definition of dream reality. Again, I could choose another term, but I want to emphasize each person's intimate contact with that other reality that does occur in what you think of as the state of dreaming. The analogy will help you at least intuitively understand the existence of situations such as suffering and poverty that otherwise seem to have no adequate explanations, as Jane and I were discussing today. Notes Rob. Seth, I hope also to account for behavior on the part of nature that certainly seems to imply the survival of the fittest in a tooth and claw fashion, or the punishing acts of a vengeful god on the one hand, and the triumph of an evil force on the other. For now in our tale of beginnings, however, we still have a spasmodic universe that appears and disappears, that gradually in those terms manifests for longer periods of time. What you really had in the beginnings were images without form, slowly adopting form, blinking on and off, then stabilizing into forms that were as yet not completely physical. These then took on all of the characteristics that you now consider formed physical matter. As all of this occurred, consciousness took on more and more specific orientations, greater organizations at your end. At the other end, it disentangled itself from vaster fields of activity to allow for this specific behavior. All of these units of consciousness, again, operate as entities, or particles, or as waves, or forces. In those terms, consciousness formed the experience of time, and not, of course, the other way around. End of dictation. A small note. Rob, Seth came through with a couple of sentences for Jane, then. Seth, I bid you a fond good evening, and we will have a session on anything you want, at any time. Rob, thank you, Seth. Good night. Seth's last remark, which I took to be a rather humorous, reflected one of the reasons for Jane's upset before the session, the conflict she feels between having just book sessions versus obtaining Seth material on at least a few of the other subjects we always have in mind. Currently, these include topics like Jonestown, Iran, Frameworks 1 and 2, and one I initiated earlier this year about human reproduction called the community of sperm. In a couple of essays I discussed and asked questions about the roles played by the 200 million to 500 million sperm that don't make contact with the female egg at the time of conception. I also wanted to know about the deep biological communication that must go on among all the sperm in a man's body at any given time, and why one of the fittest sperm in a particular ejaculate eventually doesn't always fertilize the egg. Seth has given some answers in a couple of sessions, and we want more. Originally, I'd planned to present excerpts here from our joint material, but I see now that I have no space in which to do so. Jane's delivery had turned out to be excellent this evening, her manner steady and with fewer pauses than she'd used in Monday's night session, although she didn't reach the peaks of soaring eloquence she'd touched upon in that last session. Elements of that state were present tonight. Session 891, December 26, 1979. Continuing Chapter 3 of Dreams, Evolution, and Value Fulfillment. Sleepwalkers, the World in Early Trance, the Awakening of the Species. Rob notes, no session was held last Monday evening, Christmas Eve. Instead, we had a few close friends in. All of us exchanged gifts. After the party was over, Jane and I gave each other our own presents. My high point was receiving the little book of poems and sketches she'd made for me. I hadn't created anything like that for her, though. When Jane read her poetry to me, I strongly felt, once again, her innocence and perception. Quote, the universe keeps turning into us. We had a quiet but very enjoyable Christmas day. Tonight's session may not be a formal book dictation, but it contains many connections to dreams. I don't care whether we have a book session or one on something else, Jane said as we sat down for the session at 8:50. I'm just waiting. I don't even feel him around. She thought this was strange, since during the last couple of days, she'd picked up quite a few insights from Seth on various subjects. We discussed all of them, but without making any notes. At 9:50, I guess I'm ready. It doesn't sound like the book, though. Sometimes I get a first line. Softly, dark eyes and luminous. Seth, good evening. Rob, good evening, Seth. With humor. Seth, tonight's subject matter, Great Expectations, for I am here referring to the book by Charles Dickens. Now the year 1980 exists in all of its potential versions, now in this moment. Because mass events are concerned, there is not a completely different year, of course, for each individual on the face of the planet, but there are literally an endless number of mass shared worlds in 1980 in the wings, so to speak. It is not quite as simple a matter as just deciding what events you want to materialize as reality, since you have, in your terms, a body of probabilities of one kind or another already established as the raw materials for the coming year. It would be quite improbable for you, Joseph, as Seth calls me, to suddenly turn into a tailor, for example, for none of your choices with probabilities have led toward such an action. In like manner, England, in all probability, next year will not suddenly turn into a Mohammedan nation. But within the range of workable probabilities, private and mass choices, the people of the world are choosing their probable 1980s. Long pause, notes Rob. Seth, I am taking my time here, for there are some issues that I would like to clear up that are difficult to explain. Any of the probable actions that a person considers are a part of that person's conscious thought. Just underneath, however, people also consider other sets of probabilities that may or may not reach conscious level simply because they are shunted aside or because they seem to meet with no conscious recognition. I want you to try and imagine actual events as you think of them to be the vitalized representations of probabilities, that is, as the physical versions of mental probabilities. The probabilities with which you are not consciously concerned remain psychologically peripheral. They are there, but not there, so to speak. Your conscious mind can only accept a certain sequence of probabilities as recognized experience. As I have said, the choices among probabilities go on constantly, both on conscious and unconscious levels. Events that you do not perceive as conscious experience are a part of your unconscious experience, however, to some extent. This applies to the individual, and of course, in mass, the same applies to world events. Each action seeks all of its own possible fulfillments. All that is seeks all possible experience. But in such a larger framework, in this case, that questions of, say, pain or death simply do not apply, though, certainly, they do on the physical level, all quite forcefully, notes Rob. Great expectations, basically, have nothing to do with degree, for a grass blade is filled with great expectations. Great expectations are built upon a faith in the nature of reality, a faith in nature itself, a faith in the life you are given, whatever its degree, and all children, for example, are born with those expectations. Fairy tales are indeed often, though not always, carriers of a kind of underground knowledge, as per your discussion about Cinderella. Rob notes C, the 824th session for mass events. Seth, and the greatest fairy tales are always those in which the greatest expectations went out. The elements of the physical world that are unfortunate can be changed in the twinkling of an eye through great expectations. Your education tells you that all of that is nonsense, that the world is defined by its physical aspects alone. When you think of power, you think of, say, nuclear energy or solar energy. But power is the creative energy within men's minds that allows them to use such powers, such energies, such forces. The true power is in the imagination, which dares to speculate upon that which is not yet. The imagination, backed by great expectations, can bring about almost any reality within the range of probabilities. All of the possible versions of 1980 will happen. Except for those you settle upon, all of the others will remain psychologically peripheral, in the background of your conscious experience. But all of those possible variations will be connected in one way or another. The important lessons have never really appeared in your societies. The most beneficial use of the directed will with great expectations, and that coupled with the knowledge of framework 1 and 2 activities, very simply, you want something, you dwell upon it consciously for a while. You consciously imagine it coming into the forefront of probabilities, closer to your actuality. Then you drop it like a pebble into framework 2, forget about it as much as possible for a fortnight, and do this in a certain rhythm. I gave you some New Year's resolutions last year, and it seems to me that they could be resurrected. Rob notes, I read them several times a week. I told Seth. Actually, he gave us his resolutions this year on January 1. Seth, they are as good, tell Rupert, who does not read them now, as they were then. They help focus your mind and imagination. That focusing helps you to act, to be. Now give us a moment. Rob notes, Seth came through with 2 short paragraphs for Jane. Then, Seth, now, in our book, I will be doing my best to explain the origin of your universe, and in such a way that most of the pertinent questions are answered. But man's present concept of reality is so limited that I must often resort to analogies. In the most basic of terms, as 1980 happens, the energy that comes into your universe is as new as if, in your terms, the world were created yesterday, a point that will be rather difficult to explain. All of the probable versions of 1980 spin off their own probable pasts, as well as their own probable futures, and any consciousness that exists in 1980 was, again in those terms, a part of what you think of as the beginning of the world. Now Rob notes to me, Seth, your mother did not simply choose to believe in her old age in a different past than the one that was accepted by the family. She effectively changed probabilities. She was not deluded or obsessed. Her memory in that regard now was not defective. It was the memory of the probable woman that she became. Like the entire American hostage affair in Iran, any physical event serves as a focus that attracts all of its probable versions and outcomes. The hostage situation, Rob notes now in day 53. Seth is a materialized mass dream meant to be important and vital on political and religious platforms of reality, meant to dramatize a conflict of beliefs and to project that conflict outward into the realm of public knowledge. Everyone involved was consciously and unconsciously a willing participant at the most basic levels of human behavior. And it is, of course, no coincidence that 1980 is immediately foreshadowed by that event. What will the world do with it? Your TV and news systems of communication are a part of the event itself, of course. It is, in a way, far better that these events occurred now, and in the way that they have, so that the problems appear clearly in the world arena. They are actually, thus, of a far less violent nature than they might otherwise have been. Religious beliefs will be examined, as they have not been before. Their connections and political affiliations. The Arab world still needs the West, and again, it is better that those issues come to light now, while they must, to some extent, consider the rest of the world. Do not personally give any more conscious consideration, either of you, to events that you do not want to happen. Any such concentration, to whatever degree, ties you in with those probabilities, so concentrate upon what you want. And as far as public events are concerned, take it for granted that sometimes even men are wiser than they know. Do you have questions? Rob, only a million of them, I thought. No, I guess not, I said to Seth. Seth, then I wish you a happy anniversary. Rob, thank you. Seth, and the most auspicious of 1980s, a fond good evening. Rob, thank you, Seth. Good night. Jane and I celebrate our 25th wedding anniversary tomorrow. Session 892, January 2nd, 1980. Continuing Chapter 3, Sleepwalkers, The World in Early Trance, The Awakening of the Species. From a Seth book, Dreams, Evolution, and Value Fulfillment, Volume 1. Continuing Chapter 3, Rob notes. On December 27, the night of our anniversary, Jane held an unplanned session for young married friends of ours. Although she seldom does this anymore because of the workload involved, such spontaneous expressions of her creativity helped my wife as well as others involved. I taped the session on the recorder I'd given Jane for Christmas. Our friends are to send us a transcript of the tape. Seth didn't come through last Monday evening, New Year's Eve. Instead, Jane and I gave a party for a change. The next day, we were ready to get back into our writing and painting. But first, I cleared the house of holiday paraphernalia, including our beautiful Christmas tree. I carefully propped up the tree, a balsam fir, in the woods at the back of the hill house. I told myself that next summer, the tree's skeleton would remind me of the days that had passed since 1980 began. In our terms, I knew I'd be grateful for having physically experienced every one of them. And as an artist, I'd be as much intrigued by the tree's naked structure as I had been when it bore its dense greenery. Over the weekend, we'd signed the contracts with our publisher, Prentice Hall, for Mass Events and God of Jane, and I mailed them this morning. We're progressing well on both projects. In their unique ways, I told Jane, my notes for Mass Events are the most challenging writing I've done. We're getting up at 6 a.m. again, so that we can get in a good morning's work before lunchtime. Seth, good evening. Rob, good evening, Seth. Seth, happy new year. Rob, thank you, and the same to you, I said, knowing that Seth's understanding of time was certainly much different than ours. Seth, dictation. You were each present at the beginning of the world then, though you may be present in the world now in a somewhat different fashion. Remember that each unit of consciousness is a fragment of all that is, a divine portion. Then perhaps what I'm about to explain will make more sense. For some time, in your terms, the sleepwalkers remained more or less at that level of activity, and for many centuries they used the surface of the earth as a kind of background for other activity. Their real life was what you would now call the dreaming one. They worked mentally, while asleep, constructing in their individual minds and their joint mental endeavors all of the dazzling images that would later become a mental reservoir from which men could draw. In that multidimensional array, consciousness mentally learned to form itself into EE units, atoms and molecules, electrons and chromosomes. It mentally formed the patterns through which all physical life could flow. The world then came into physical existence. Those units of consciousness are indestructible and vitalized, regardless of the forms they take, and while men's forms were dream images, consciousness spun forms into physical matter. Consciousness possesses the most unimaginable agility without ever losing any potency. Those units of consciousness, for example, can mix and combine with others to form a million different sequences of memory and desire, of neural achievement and recognition, of structure and design. You read your own consciousness now in a kind of vertical fashion, identifying only with certain portions of it. And it seems to you that any other organization of perception, any other recognition of identity, would quite necessarily negate your own or render it inoperable. In the beginning of the world, there were numberless groupings, however, and affiliations of consciousness, many other organizations of identity that were recognized, as well as the kind of psychological orientation you have now. But your kind of orientation was not the paramount one. While generally speaking, Earth's species existed from the beginning in the forms by which you now know them, consciousness of species was quite different, and all species were much more intimately related through various kinds of identification that have since gone into the underground of awareness. Initially, then, the world was a dream, and what you think of as waking consciousness was the dreaming consciousness. In that regard, the Earth's entire environment was built mentally, atom by conscious atom, each atom again being initially formed by units of consciousness. I said that these units could operate as entities and as forces, so we are not speaking of a mental mechanics, but of entities in the true meaning of the word, entities of unimaginable creative and psychic properties, purposeful fragments propelled from the infinite mind. As that mind was filled with the inspiration that gave light to the world, those entities, in your terms so ancient, left fragments of themselves in trance, so to speak, that form the rocks and hills, the mountains, the air and the water, and all of the elements that exist on the face of the earth. Those entities are in trance, in those terms, but their potency is not diminished, and there is constant communication among them always. There is also constant communication between them and you at other levels than those you recognize, so that there is an unending interplay between each species and its environment. There is no place where consciousness stops and the environment begins, or vice versa. Each form of life is created along with each other form, environment, and organism, in those terms creating each other. After forms were fully physical, however, all species operated as sleepwalkers for many centuries, though on the scale that existed then, the passage of time was not considered in the same fashion. During that period, the work of wedding non-physical consciousness into matter was accomplished. Effects of gravity, for example, were stabilized. The seasons took on the rhythms best suited to the creatures in various locations. The environment and the creatures accommodated each other. Up until then, the main communications had followed the characteristic patterns of units of consciousness, each unit knowing its relationship to all others upon the planet. Creatures relied upon inner senses while learning to operate the new, highly specific physical ones that pinpointed perception in time and place. This pinpointing of perception was of vital importance, for with the full arousal of consciousness in flesh, intersections with space and time had to be impeccable. Dream bodies became physical, and through the use of the senses, tuned to physical frequencies, frequencies of such power and allure that they would reach all creatures of every kind, from microbe to elephant, holding them together in a cohesive web of space and time alignment. In the beginning, man's dreams were in certain terms of immediate physical survival. They gave man information, a kind that of necessity the new physical senses could not contain. Those senses could only perceive the immediate environment, but man's dreams compensated for that lack and filled out his consciousness by giving it the benefit of that larger generalized information to which it had once had an easy access. When he was asleep, man could take advantage of the information banks contained in the units of consciousness that composed his very flesh. Now, underlined. When he dreamed, man actually returned to a state prior to waking, from which his physical life itself had emerged. Only now he was a new creature, a new kind of consciousness, and so were all of the other species. In dreams, all of the species familiarized themselves with their old affiliations, and they read their own identities in different fashions. They remembered how it was. They remembered that they formed each other. This tale, I admit, is far more difficult to explain than a simple story of God's creation of the world, or its actual production in a meaningless universe through the slippery hands of chance. And yet my story is more magnificent, because elements of its truth will find resonance in the minds and hearts of those open enough to listen. For men's minds themselves are alive with the desire to read properly, and they are aware of their own vast heritage. It is not simply that man has a soul that is somehow blessed while the rest of him is not, but that in those terms everything he knows, regardless of size or degree, is made of soul stuff. Each portion has its own identity and validity, and no portion is ever annihilated or destroyed. The form may change. I must of necessity tell this story in serial terms, but the world and all of its creatures actually come together like some spontaneously composed, ever-playing musical composition, in which the notes themselves are alive and play themselves, so that the musicians and notes are one and the same. The purpose and the performance being one, with each note played continuing to strike all of its own probable versions, forming all of its own probable compositions, while at the same time taking part in all of the themes, melodies, and notes of the other compositions, so that each note striking defines itself, and yet also exists by virtue of its position in the composition as a whole. The conscious mind cannot handle that kind of multidimensional creativity, yet it can expand into a kind of new recognition when it is carried along, still being itself by its own theme. In a way, your world follows its own theme in creativity's composition. You want to know where you came into the musical production, so to speak. I use a musical analogy here, if a simple one, to point out that we are also dealing with frequencies of perception. You are tuned into Earth's orchestration, you might say, and your perceptions of time is simply the result of habits, habits of perception that you had to learn in the beginning of the world. And you learned those habits as your physical senses gradually became more alert and specific. You timed yourselves, but greater perceptions always appeared in the background of your consciousnesses and in the dream state. It is the great activity of the dream state that allows you, as psychological and physical creatures, to recognize and inhabit the world that you know. End of dictation. You did an excellent job of your own dream interpretation, and Rupert unwittingly added to it with his poetry. Do you have any questions? Rob, have you got anything to say for the beginning of the year like you did with your resolutions for the start of last year? With considerable humor, staring at me, Seth, I thought I gave you my 1980 speech last time. Rob, okay. Seth, continue with the resolutions. I expect that sessions like this evening's will themselves help you understand the nature of Framework 1 and 2 and the importance of your mental activity in bringing about physical events. Rob, I was thinking about that. Seth, I bid you a fond good evening. Rob, thank you, Seth. Good night. Jane said she'd been pretty far out during the session, then added later while we talked that she was picking up from Seth information on the beginning of our own world, species, and civilizations that he intended to give in the next session. Seth then was capable of coming through with that material right now. Only Jane's and my own conventions of time and habit, even concerning a phenomenon as unusual as the sessions, stopped him from doing so. Inevitably, the session Jane delivers for Seth next Monday evening will be somewhat different from the one she could produce tonight. There are many interesting implications here. End chapter 3.